ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The best design? You never notice it. The kettle, the beanbag, the umbrella, they look the way they do because someone somewhere made a decision and that decision stuck. What does that say about them? And what does it say about us? The objects all around you have a story. Hear them on By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Search By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Australia, we have a problem, a major shortage of sperm, with profound consequences for the future of families. Yes, intimate insights today into the messy world of modern conception. Welcome to Big Ideas. Hey, Natasha Mitchell bringing you Big Thinkers at the best live events today from the 2026 All About Women Festival, presented by the Sydney Opera House on Gadigal Country. Now, whether you or your partner has fertility issues, or you're single and really want to have a child, or you're in a queer relationship, the path to parenthood can be a circuitous one. It can also be costly, involve all sorts of awkward conversations with prospective donors, some legal grey zones, and a whole lot of anticipation, patience, and pitfalls. Despite the hurdles, though, many make it work, as you'll hear today. Alicia Burns is founder of the Solo Mum Society, host of the No Need for Prince Charming podcast, and author of the children's book My Perfect Family. Maeve Marsden is curator of queer stories and the creative director of Varuna, the National Writers' House, and the Blue Mountains Writers Festival. Bigumbul and Waka Waka woman and writer Dr. Melanie Saywood is lecturer in Australian Studies at the University of Queensland, and the host is Edwina Story, a journalist with SBS's The Feed. And we'd love to hear from you as you're listening. And if you relate, email us bigideas@abc.net.au or the Radio National text line 0418 226 576.
Now, for anyone unfamiliar with this journey, I just wanted to give a couple of brief cliff notes. So in Australia, all sperm, egg, and surrogacy donations must be altruistic. Donors can't be paid. And there are essentially three types of sperm donor category. There's firstly clinic donors who donate via an IVF sperm bank. And many IVF clinics are finding that there's not enough local donors for the demand, particularly following COVID. Then we've got known donors who are often a friend or a family member. And thirdly, recruited donors who are also under the umbrella of the known donor, but they're often a stranger you might find online, like my partner Claire and I did in the depths of Facebook, who agrees to help you make a child. But I have to note that many experts highlight that there are several risks going through unregulated sites. And there are a multitude of reasons why anyone might choose any of these options. It can depend on your personal values, relationships, and timing. So that kind of sets us up. This kind of sets up the like high-stakes situation that a lot of people are in. I think when a lot of people start this journey, the thing that comes to mind is maybe the sperm donor banks and the endless profile options available. And then you suddenly realise that there is a bit of a shortage. Alicia and Mel, you each used clinic donors or chose to use clinic donors. Can you tell me about the expectation when you were starting your journey versus the reality? And I'll start with you, Alicia.
Yeah, so I didn't do a lot of research into my clinic. I went with a specialist that my friends were using because he was a doctor and I decided he must have done good research and just assumed that every single clinic had a sperm bank and that it would just be an easy thing to do. I thought about the Friends episode where Monica starts looking through all of these books and thought it would be the same. I didn't realise so much that it was altruistic and all the rest of it or how limited it was. I was lucky that I did it before COVID and I think I had 14 Caucasian donors to choose from because I wanted to go with the same ethnicity as myself. Now, a lot of women are lucky if they've got one or two to choose from, and it really does depend on what state you're in as well. But yeah, I was like, all of these things, I'll be able to specify what I'm looking for with height and eye colour and all the rest, and no. So it was really very much for me down to the answers that my donor had written, and I thought, if I ever met him, I feel like I would get on well with him, and I felt like I could have written the same, so it would hopefully be a good person to create a child with, which turned out pretty well.
And Mel, how about yourself?
I chose my clinic based on vibes of the doctor. He made a crass joke about coming in jars at an information night, and I was like, oh, if he can make a joke about how stupid this is, I like this doctor. So I chose that clinic. Obviously, a lot of research went into that. And I had the same sort of impression. I have friends in the US that had gone through donor conception, and they'd said, oh, it's like a kind of like a Tinder website, and you can swipe through and pick your donor that way. And they said it was really fun, and that they had a glass of wine and asked their mums and their sisters to come round and do that, help doing their choosing, because it was a way, I was trying for a baby as a single person, and it was a way of involving your family in that process of choosing to become a parent. And yeah, I got to the clinic and also thought that I was going to be able to find an Indigenous donor to, again, match my cultural heritage. And so when I walked into that appointment, I was like, am I going to be able to find an Aboriginal man, a Torres Strait Islander man that's donated? And they were like, oh, there was one black fella about 10 years ago. and he's all gone now, is how they spoke about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was very disappointing at that moment.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of this journey can involve a lot of personal compromise, personal discovery and a lot of personal compromise.
Yeah.
Can you tell me further about how the process moved along for you once you realised, yeah, they had one donor way back when?
Yeah, it was quite sickening that day at the clinic. I think it was about $500 to become a member of my clinic, and I paid that first and then had a whole day of appointments booked at the clinic, which was a counselling appointment, which they're absolutely gammon if we talk about those. It was terrible, and they were running late, and I'd paid the money and the counselling session was horrible, and then I walked into the session where they were going to tell me about the donors, which was the part that I was just like, get me to that part, because this is the part that I want, and then walked into that room, and that was also not what I expected. It made all of my, it just made a lot of my enthusiasm drain away for the process, and it made it really hard because it had taken a lot of processing to get to the point where I was ready to join the clinic to pay the money and go through it. So it was very, very disappointing. And then the compromises that I made was, do you want to have a baby that has another cultural heritage of it? I think about, you know, those things is a responsibility to think about when you're going with a donor. And I was on groups, it wasn't your group, but I was on a Facebook group that they had suggested to me to go to as a single person and talk about how to choose and have those conversations. And I logged in and I was here, I was watching conversations about, well, there's a lot of South Asian donors and maybe Asian donors. And then they were talking about things like, oh, my baby's going to look so cute because I've got this skin colour, and then blending it together, it's going to look like this. And of course, that made my gorge rise as well, because I was here thinking so deeply about the cultural inheritance of my child. So it was a very tough process.
Yeah.
We've had conversations like that on my Facebook group recently. And it's kind of the opposite, which is really nice to hear.
Yeah.
And it's more, if you are, because there's such a shortage of Caucasian donors, and that seems to be the majority that people want at the moment, people are making decisions based on, I just want to get pregnant and have a baby. And they're not thinking about those long-term implications for the child.
Mm.
And so it was a woman of colour saying, really think about this. Yes, you can bring their culture through and food and people and that sort of thing, but have you lived in the shoes of the child that you're going to be creating? Are you going to be prepared to support them if there's systemic racism, which there is a lot of, unfortunately, in Australia, or some of the other things that might come on, the unconscious bias that they're going to face? Are you prepared to actually support them through that? So I'm glad that we're having different conversations than what you had.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Do you find the counselling touches on that at all?
No.
Good to be fair, mine was like, it's quite possible to make sure that you're not going to sue them. It's not really counselling.
Mine was 7 years ago, and I did have a good experience, but it wasn't about that. It was more about making sure that I was going to disclose, and it's no shame or secrecy. So hopefully learning from previous generations, but there's probably a lot more that can go into those sessions.
Mm, yeah.
Alicia, you help women determine if they want to be a solo mom and what kind, you know, if they feel it's best to go with a known donor or a recruited donor or a clinic donor. What do you tell people to consider?
I think the biggest thing is just really thinking about the long-term implications of the decision that you're making now. To even make the decision to become a solo mum by choice, that takes a long time. It's a lot of grieving of the life that you thought you were going to have and thinking through all the complications and can I really do this on my own? Getting over the fear of judgment that you think that there's going to be all this other stuff. So you make the decision and that's actually the hardest part. And then you're like, cool, I just want to get pregnant now. Mm. And when there's shortages, you may be getting forced into non-regulated channels or making decisions that you wouldn't have if you felt like you had more time. Mm. But you've got to be able to own that for your child when they're older. You've got to be able to support them with whatever the story is that they're going to have, because it's not just you creating a child, it's their origin story. Mm. So are you going to be proud to tell them, I just met someone on Facebook and after 2 days we did home insemination and I didn't really think too much about it, and then find out that I've got like 50,000 siblings because they're a prolific donor? Or did I do the due diligence and like ask all the questions, go through the process, you know, get legal involved to make sure you're having the hard conversations, because you didn't know this person before. And if someone's like going, I don't want to do that, then maybe that's a red flag and someone you don't want as a donor. Mm.
Sorry, I just bear in mind that when we talk about the IVF system as being regulated, that those regulations have changed a huge amount in my lifetime alone. And so an interpersonal exchange on Facebook or otherwise is not necessarily harder to trust than a massive corporation where the regulation is different in every state and changes a lot. And so the rules that you sign up for might change according to a corporation rather than an individual. Mm. I just want to pull that apart a bit, because the clinics sell a particular kind of level of trust on the basis that we can't trust each other. Mm. And I think that, you know, like we can trust other human beings as much or more as we can trust large corporations with shareholders.
Yeah, there's nothing to say, unfortunately, that a donor you get through a clinic isn't also donating in private channels. Yep. But it's just making sure that you, if you are going that way, that you're having really robust conversations to make sure that you trust that person. And getting clear on boundaries as well, especially for solo women. I do know quite a few women who have met their donor online and then the donor wants to have some sort of involvement in their family that's not what they signed up for. Mm. So it's just making sure that you're not rushing into things, looking through all the options.
Yeah, I want to dig into that more, because we did find our donor on Facebook. Before that, we had a couple of conversations with friends, and those are deeply delicate conversations to navigate. It's very hard to ask someone for their sperm and to ask if they would help you create a baby. And I have to say, there were times when it felt like, at least for me, like very disempowering, that it's like, well, we really want this thing, but we need someone else, at least one person, if not a whole team, to help us create it when, and it feels like a very, feels very vulnerable to be in. Mm-hmm. And then to also ask someone to be your donor is a hugely big thing for them to consider, and they may have to like talk with their family. It's like, it's a very generous consideration. But Maeve, you asked an old friend.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so the context for me is that I myself am donor conceived. So I was born in 1983, had lesbian parents who asked two friends, and between those two guys, me and my two siblings were born. So we each have slightly different genetic makeup. And that was a really positive experience for me growing up, and a very positive experience for them. Those men, my own donor has passed away, but those men were incredibly generous to do that for two lesbians in 1983. So that's my experience growing up. So unlike a lot of, I think, queer people who in their early 20s are going, how am I possibly going to make a family? I was like, gotta find a man. and I made friends with this beautiful guy, Cameron, when we were like 18 at the uni bar. And it was this kind of like, and then when we grow up, we'll make a baby together. And it'll be so beautiful. So that meant it happened quite naturally in that sense. And then as we got older, like he had a partner who disagreed with that idea, and he found himself defending the decision we'd made in his 20s. And he came to me and he was like, I found that I was quite committed to this. And so we had this beautiful kind of 15-year process of talking this through. And by the time I met my partner, I was like, I come with a donor in tow. And and she had worked with him and knew him. So it was this quite beautiful, like, I mean, I love story. Like, we talk about these conversations as being difficult, but the creation of a child with a partner or by yourself or with a friend or a known donor can be this like really beautiful process. And yes, it's messy, and yes, it's vulnerable making, but so too is having a conversation with a partner about having a child. So too is advocating for yourself as a solo parent. Like, we're making human beings. It should be complicated, and I wish more people who could just have sex to make babies thought about it this deeply. And so, but then we did have to, of course, nut out the logistics. By this point, Cameron had moved to Canada to live with a partner, and so we had to bring him back, and we had to go through a clinic rather than do the DIY process that my parents did. And so we had to go through all of those counselling appointments and things like that, which I have endometriosis, so we probably would have ended up there anyway. So for me, it was quite natural, and I already had the language, and sometimes my partner says that I forget that this isn't everybody else's normal, you know, like that I have assumptions about how this is how you make children. Like a straight couple just having sex to make a baby, that's so weird. And so it's been really a beautiful thing. And since then, one of Cameron's siblings has gone on to donate because he saw how beautiful it was that Cameron did it for us. And I've had a lot of friends over my life come to me and ask for advice in how to approach their friends. And so a lot of people in my networks have gone with a known donor, in part because they could ask me those knotty questions and they saw how well it's worked out, both for me as a child and now as a parent. And my kid knows Cameron and knows Phil, Cameron's partner, and like knows that their donor conceived, and we have the, my kid's 4.5 and we're sort of having those conversations. Sorry, that was a long answer, but...
No.
Yeah.
You can continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the answer. Yeah,
it's interesting, like... Did you find... So you've always been very open with your child about their donor. Yep. Okay. And as something I was thinking about is when it came to trying to navigate those conversations with strangers online, it's it feels very unusual. You're trying to like look for red flags and maybe that's it. But you're trying to get to know someone quite quickly and get a good gut feeling for them to know if you can create this person together. And there's a lot of kind of surprising things to navigate and not having the donor conceived experience.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think I don't have the experience of looking for someone online. I have the experience of my partner and I spending a lot of time talking about our friends. And we had a couple of friends who offered. And it's like flirting. You're sort of like, have you ever considered donating sperm to a lesbian couple? But I think the more we have these conversations casually, the more we talk about it socially, the more people might pop up and say, actually, yeah, I would do that for you. And people, like I know somebody who used, like the partner got pregnant. I know two couples where the partner got pregnant with the other partner's brother because they wanted some of the... I know one family where they then call the kids of that family brusins because they're like brothers and cousins. It's okay for it to be... Isn't that adorable?
Well, it's like a brother cousin.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, maybe problematic now that I say it out loud. Yeah. We'll follow that up later.
It's got a whole new way.
But I think that it's okay for it to be hard. It's okay when you're engaging with someone to be going, well, what are the red flags? Much as you would with a partner. Like how many women are there trying to work out if their husbands are going to do any housework once the child comes? Like, we should be looking for red flags in the people with whom we make a family. And having those difficult conversations with, whether it's a stranger who you found on Facebook or a person you know, prepares you for how difficult parenthood is. Like, you are going to have a lot of difficult conversations with your partner, with other people in your life about how, with your, if you're lucky enough to have your parents alive, the conversations with grandparents about how things have changed and how you want them to care for your child. Like, parenthood is endless difficult conversations. And so I suppose I'd say lean into that, lean into trying to navigate it, put legal boundaries in place if that makes you comfortable. Don't trust the IVF counselling to really be counselling. Do it yourself and treat it as an honour or a privilege that you get to be a parent who's done this deep thinking. As opposed to, like, there's nothing wrong if you just had kids by accident, that's also fine. Like, there's so many different ways to make a family, but deep thought is exciting. It shouldn't be frightening.
Yeah. I just emphatically agree.
Vigorously nodding yes.
What it really takes to make a baby in the complicated world of donor sperm conception. Hey, Natasha Mitchell bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today from the All About Women Festival presented by the Sydney Opera House. With Alicia Burns, the founder of the Solo Mum Society, host of the No Need for Prince Charming podcast, creative producer and queer stories curator Maeve Marsden, Dr. Melanie Sayward, a humanities scholar at the University of Queensland, and asking the questions is SBS's Edwina Story, who is a seasoned reporter on all things sex and gender. Now they're diving into the legal landscape of sperm donations.
Let's talk about the legalities, because for some people it can be a big concern. If you conceive through an IVF clinic, even if you have a known donor that you BYO or a clinic donor, there are protections that automatically sever any responsibilities between the donor and the parents. But that doesn't apply if you conceive outside of the clinic. So I know my partner and I found ourselves like rapidly trying to find a contract online to download and edit like a couple of days before a DIY turkey insemination, turkey-based insemination. And even though we felt like we needed to do this, even though we knew it wasn't legally binding, but it felt really necessary at the time because we'd met this incredible donor and his partner and we adore them and feel like it just all feels very right. But then it was leading up to you're coming down to the high stakes of I'm ovulating in 2 days and, you know, we're only going to see them for a couple of days and this all needs to time very perfectly. And so we were writing up this contract that wasn't really going to mean a whole lot, but it was kind of a statement of intention and this point of recognizing that while we met each other and we trusted one another implicitly, we did only just meet like a couple of weeks or months ago. And so, and it was this kind of safety net for the donors and for us to be like, okay, we've just put things on the table. Mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of like legal gray areas, and that is a concern for some people and not for others. Alicia, when it comes to solo parents, what are the concerns for them?
I think the biggest problem that we've got at the moment is that the Family Law Act still hasn't been updated to reflect that a child can have just one parent. So even if you go DIY or if you go through a clinic and then make contact with the donor and they have some sort of relationship in your life, there's still a risk that they could be granted parental rights to your child if you were to go to court for it. Because at the end of the day, you've got a contract with intention. It's still it's in what's in the child's best interest. But you have two parents for your child. Mm-hmm. Mine does not. Mm-hmm. So until the Family Law Act is updated, there's still a risk that a judge who is maybe a bit more conservative than we'd like would grant that to our child. So it's something that people really need to be aware of.
Yeah. Mel, was it anything that you had to consider?
Yeah, it was a huge consideration for me. If you think about these clinics, I think one of the things that we forget too, and I was so aware of it on that first day sitting in the room, was that you feel the same as the other people sitting in that clinic, but I realised really quickly that I wasn't the same, that there was a level of privilege with many of the other folks sitting in there that are, you know, they could walk in and try multiple rounds, and that yes, it is a lot of money for anyone, but like finding $10,000 wasn't that hard for some people. And I had that on top of the fact I was working several jobs at the life of an artist, I suppose, and didn't have secure employment and was buying a house at the same time and trying to save money and time everything right. Mm. And then also just being so terrified that this baby that I was creating, that I was like, I am mum, that's the family that kid needs. And then just thinking, but if someone with money came in and said, I want 50-50, or I was struggling financially and said they wanted more, then you're exactly right. A judge could decide that even though I'd paid all this money for that child. Mm. And then to me, it started feeling like then I was commodifying the life of my child before it came along. So, yeah, I was always going through the clinic because of the so-called legal protections, but the corporate stuff was always there in the back of my mind that, you know, this is the business of healthcare, I think. And I'd worked in marketing for healthcare for a long time and understood and had grappled with. I worked in cancer marketing, cancer care marketing, but cancer marketing, ew. And this
I assume you were marketing the prevention of cancer, right?
Not getting it.
Rebranding it.
Cancer drugs, actually, was what we were doing. So it was essential chemotherapy drugs, right? Mm. And I hated that we were going in saying to doctors, use our drugs, they're the best, right? Mm. And to me, when I walked into that clinic, I was so hyper aware that, you know, you pay $500 to be a member of the clinic, you pay $1,300 or however much it is now for your overseas sperm, you pay this much. Yeah. Plus, you're not legally protected because the corporate and the board of this organisation could change.
Yeah.
And the laws could change. So,
it's such a good point you make about who the clinics are for as well, because I think almost all the public discourse about donor conception is led by single parents or single mothers and queer people. Actually, once you walk into a clinic, the bulk of the people attending these clinics are straight people with fertility issues. Mm-hmm. And so that is who the clinics are set up for. And great, like people with fertility issues need help. But it means that all the forms, all the counselling appointments, all the approaches are done to protect straight couples with fertility issues. And so it's lovely that we have this conversation. But like when we talk about anonymous donors, we're talking about in a context where you have to tell your kid from day one that they had a donor because like there's no
it's
dad there.
It's such an easy conversation.
And so we have this wonderful conversation about how important it is to be honest with our children in a context where we have no choice but to be honest with donor-conceived children. There are a lot of straight couples out there not telling their kids that they're donor-conceived, and that is the bulk of the clinic's clientele. And so when we start to sort of rail against the clinics, it's because if you are queer or you are marginalised and you walk into that space, like I used a clinic, I needed to, but I did not think it was for me and I did not feel supported or safe in that environment. I used it because I had to.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, yes, amend the Family Law Act to have one parent, but also amend it so that we could have three or four. Some people are making really complex families with donors and, you know, parents, and we can't reflect those either. Like, family structures are so complex and diverse and the boundaries that we then have to make them in are so narrow. Mm.
And then the fact that there's no national regulations when it comes to donors anyway. So depending on what state you are, depends on family limits, depends on how easy it is to make contact with the donor early or donor siblings. And there's so much research showing how beneficial that can be.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to do that. And then you've got clinics that are trying to adhere to, say, a 10 family limit in Vic. And then there's nothing stopping that donor going and doing unregulated channels and nothing to hold them accountable. So you can still have the same problem.
And then scare tactics about doing it in an interpersonal way as if the clinics are the ones we can trust. Mm. And it's like, well, I trust my ability to form human relationships.
Mm. Yeah. I had a conversation with a donor-conceived person like at some point in mine, and they were talking about how their parent had been told 10 family limit. And for those of you who don't know, they say each sperm donor is allowed to create 10 families or whatever. It's the same in Queensland.
It's 10.
And it's 10 families. And they'd say families because, you know, if you create one baby, you can buy that semen and try and create another one. So you might have five kids by that same sperm donor. That's not five families. Mm. Does that make sense to everybody? And so they were saying things like that, but their parent had bought the overseas semen. Mm-hmm. So there's Australian and overseas, and it's 10 families at that clinic. So this donor could be in the US where they don't have the same laws and protections and be donating for money because they're paid in the US. And this donor-conceived person had found that they had 70, 80 siblings by going on like Ancestry.com and doing a DNA thing. And that was at the point where I started going, oh, all they're offering me is overseas because otherwise I get a blonde hair, blue-eyed white fella. So they're offering me overseas and I could then be creating this child that has 80 siblings all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's no regulation between the clinics.
Yeah. And there was a rapid review recently that recommends to kind of implement all like uniform family limits. But it is.
And it's still recommended, right? Like we're still not at the part where
Even the wording is different. Like for New South Wales, it's like you can donate to 5 women.
Yeah.
And it's like, so wait, if you're in a same-sex couple...
I know of a same-sex couple where that proved a difficulty when the other parent wanted to get pregnant. The clinic deemed them 2 families and were like, oh, he's hit his limit. You need a different donor. And so it makes having an awkward conversation with your friend slightly more appealing.
Yes. Or even finding someone on Facebook.
And it's hard to talk about this stuff because I never, ever want to come across as saying that using anonymous sperm is a problem. I know so many people with kids conceived via anonymous sperm, the kids are great, they're happy. And I loved what you said at the start about the story you tell. Like, I think so much of who I am as a person is the stories my mother's told me about what it meant to be in a lesbian family at that time and the stories I had about my donor and who he was. Like, it mattered deeply to me. Mm. And so, yeah, family is built by story. But when we use anonymous sperm from a clinic, I just haven't seen enough discussion publicly, other than by grown-up donor-conceived people, where we're talking about how unreliable those clinics can be with our data and our information. And so when I get like this platform, knowing what other donor-conceived adults my age are saying, I always try to go, if you have the option of someone you know where you can pull it out of the clinic, it can be a really good option in terms of what grown-up donor-conceived people are saying now. With the caveat that I know heaps of people with anonymous donors who are happy.
Yeah.
Like I just it's a really hard thing to be like, system bad, individual families lovely.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think the other important thing for people who may not be aware is that there is no such thing as a proper anonymous donation anymore in Australia. They're all ID released. So depending on the state, again, when the child turns 16 or 18, they can get identifying information about the donor and every state has a central register so they can connect and that sort of thing. There's not enough in place, I think, for voluntary, for those who want to connect earlier or connect with siblings. It's not an easy thing to do. And it should be that if they are using international donors, that the international donors are adhering to the state regulations for that clinic. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to a reputable clinic, then hopefully that is what they're doing and they're adhering to it and that they are state-specific with all that. But until there's national regulations, it makes it hard for the clinics as well as everyone else trying to do it. So not an easy one.
No.
That complex intersection of law, medicine, ethics, and the primal longing to make a baby when you depend on donor sperm. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Alicia Burns, Maeve Marsden, Dr. Melanie Saywood are in conversation with journalist Edwina Story today, who now wants to address the elephant in the room. Money, money, money. Back to the stage of the Sydney Opera House.
Let's talk about money. Because of course, finances, I know we've touched on it a little bit, but finances can be a big part of the process, particularly when you're going through an IVF clinic. And I know there was like a small financial pro for us to have a known donor and we didn't have to go through a clinic and be like, we need to buy up all the vials of sperm, or every time we wanted to give it a shot at getting pregnant, we didn't have to like book all the appointments. We could just get on a plane and go do an insemination, ask politely for a cup of sperm.
Please, sir.
And it was a lovely experience. Mel, can you tell me about how finances ultimately played, like the role that they ultimately played in your journey?
Yeah, they had a big factor in the fact that I am sitting up here as the, and I'm going to say childless, because I know the words that we use are really important. Child-free, I love that there are people saying that, child-free by choice and so on. But for me, I'm not child-free. I'm childless. I wanted a child. I will not have a child. That's the reality for me now. And it's okay. Like, I feel the energy went whoo in the room. But it's actually okay. But it did prevent me from going probably as many times as I would have liked to have. So I had 2 IUIs, which was the intrauterine insemination, which is basically the clinic version of the turkey baster, which they also try to tell you is more accurate because they use a small speculum and it goes blah, blah. not always wait. And then when I was working towards IVF, I'd found a different clinic because I obviously had problems where I had gone before that did mostly bulk build IVF. So I had to go through it all again, the same regulations because it was a different clinic, another counselling appointment, meeting the doctor, blood tests, more expenses. And then ultimately, even though they were going to bulk bill, the fact that I needed to still have about $10,000 up front to start my treatment stopped me from doing it as a single person, because also at the same time I was thinking, am I going to put myself into a huge amount of debt to create a child that I then have, you know, like I'll have to take time off work, my income comes down for, you know, maternity leave. I'll probably have to go back in 6 months. I'm going to work for childcare. My parents didn't live near me at the time. And so it just got to the point where I was like, financially, it's actually unfair to do this. I may have tried again, but my body made the decision for me. I got quite unwell and ended up having a hysterectomy. But that was a big part of the conversation with, especially with my gynecologist when I was making the decision to go, because she'd known how adamant I'd wanted to be to have a baby. But yeah, the finances absolutely affected that, because I felt like time ran out, you know. When I decided I wanted to do this, I was, I just turned 30. That was when I was, felt my body was like, I just put a baby in me, basically. And but then I started like investigating it, and it probably wasn't until I was 34 that I started going through the treatments. And so yeah, it was definitely that. And then I got very resentful of people, because I was like, my sister was trying for her second baby and she would tell me about how difficult it was, and I was like, with respect, babe, like, you can come home and jump in whenever you want to and it doesn't cost you any money. Every time I want to put that inside of me, that's at least $10,000. And you also have a partner, so it, that stuff was really difficult. Yeah. And so then, you know, time runs out. Like, it takes time to save that amount of money as a single person to do that. So it probably is part of the reason why I don't have a kid. Because if I'd had the money when I was 30, when I made the decision, I probably would have started, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And time becomes such a crucial part of this whole thing. Like, because you're trying to find the donor and trying to make these big life decisions that you know are going to affect your entire future and the future of your family and many people around you, and also your biological ticking clock that we're constantly reminded about.
And my grandmother used to say to me, and I have said to my mum so many times, geez, I'm glad Nan wasn't alive to watch me go through that, because she used to ring me when I was 18 and tell me, clock's ticking, when I was 18. And so I was like, I hate that I got to 35 and could hear her saying, clock's ticking. Yeah.
And even there's the, at the moment, our donor sperm is in quarantine, and it feels like quarantine jail, because it's this 3-month period where it's, you know, a legal requirement to make sure that they don't have any particular health conditions, but it feels, again, disempowered. It's like someone else has the decision over this, not me.
Yeah, and that's taking,
like,
that's
like, I could
stealing,
go out to a bar and it would be totally
and
different.
Did people, have people said that to you? Because like, some of the most conservative white fellas in my family went to me, you could just go out to a nightclub. I know someone who's done that before. And I was like, yeah, and then they have custody rights to my child. Yeah, but people would say these whacked out things to me when I was talking about the money. Oh, just do that.
But that relates to the stuff we were saying about legalities too, like that we put in place so many like protections, but people will normalise a one night stand.
Yeah.
No one says to like a couple having kids, oh, have you written like a prenup as to custody for when you split up? And it's far more common to watch people split up and have a custody battle than a known donor come back for their kid. But like, we do the legal protections, but the normal arrangement, everyone's just like, go have a one night stand. It's like, no. I mean, I did offer to do that when we were waiting, and Nikki was like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
It's like, I could get a man. I simply could not and would not.
I come back to that, the story you'll be proud of telling your child about the origins.
Hey, no shame.
You underestimate the stories I tell. The stories I'm proud of, Alicia. The money is, it's huge though, isn't it? And it does stop people continuing. It's probably why we won't go in for a second child, my partner and I, because that question of like, well, yeah, I think by the time we were done, over time, we spent about 80 grand.
Yeah.
And that's across
and
5 years.
And
it's across
used
5 years.
And we had a known donor.
And we had a known donor. I mean, I had fertility issues. Yeah. So there's part of it is that. But I was considered at that time socially infertile until I could prove it. Time got slowed because my doctor neglected to tell me until we were quite a way into the process that she had a BMI cutoff and I was too fat. And so she hadn't told me that at the first appointment. If she had, I could have, you know, made choices then. But she told me when we'd already done a bunch of IUIs and started the whole process with her. So I had to pause for 18 months and like reinvigorate my teenage eating disorder. Sorry, I joke about it. I'm sorry to anybody else who doesn't joke about those things. But I did, and I lost 25 kilos. And then I went back to her and I was like, okay, I'm good to go. And I got IVF and had a baby. And ultimately, as soon as I was happy and eating again, I put most of that weight back on. But there's no, she didn't provide a health framework to lose that weight. She didn't sort of say, well, hang on, you should be doing that. I had said to her that I'd had disordered eating issues as a teenager and that that's why I wasn't actively trying to lose weight. And she didn't say, well, if I'm putting this limit on you in order for you to access this healthcare, here is a referral to a therapist who can support you. Here is a referral to a personal trainer. I just stopped eating properly because I wanted a child. But like those kind of conversations, the financial impact, the legal impact, the health impact on a person's body of going through these treatments, it's huge.
And,
it's huge.
And then I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that finances were cutting me off, but I still had the privilege to save the money to go twice.
Yeah.
And I just keep thinking about there are so many people that are like, well, I just don't have the money for that. You know, people in my community mob who want to have babies that cannot afford it, you know, that it's disproportionate that it, I don't know, it just makes me really sick that finance is going to, for a lot of people, make the decision about whether they become parents or not.
Yeah. And I guess I should say that it is like very sophisticated and expensive science. Like it is, we're lucky to have it. But yeah, it's excruciating that it can come down to, yeah, how much money you make, how much you have capacity to save, who you are, what circumstance you're born into.
And none of those counselling appointments say to you, like check your finances or know that you're thinking it like, oh, if you put yourself into debt to do this, how are you going to pay for the baby that you get in the end of it? Like they don't make you think about that.
I mean,
sort
it was fascinating to me what was free once I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Like once I was pregnant, I was like walking in and out of hospitals getting care and never, and I kept being like getting my wallet out and they were like, no, you're pregnant now. And so suddenly I had free healthcare and I was just like, this is a weird old system, like, but, you know, a system that we're working within.
Mm. Alicia, yeah, what do you notice? Do the women in your community talk about the finances a lot?
Absolutely. And it's, I think one of the big wins that we had last year is that the Medicare system changed. So at least now single women can just be deemed socially infertile from the beginning and don't have to prove
infertile.
They're socially infertile, so they don't have to prove they're infertile by doing the two IUIs had to do, which just felt like people were pouring money down the drain, really, especially if age was a factor and everything else. So that's one win, but yeah, it is still probably one of the biggest considerations
for
most
people.
You don't
have to go in and be told that you're fat to be told infertile too, because that's what I got to. It was like, oh, ticking the box, you're over 30, cool, you're probably infertile. You're fat, cool, you're probably infertile. Like, you're Aboriginal, cool, you're probably infertile. Like, it was just all of that. So I ticked boxes in the start.
And you still had to do IUI?
Yeah,
that was your choice?
Twice. Yeah.
At least I got to go straight to IVF, but I had history of fertility issues and baby loss and things like that as well. So I was lucky, but I went into it going, I'm only going to do two rounds. If it doesn't work out, I'm not meant to be a mum. Mm. And I had to set that financial limit, and I started probably 6 months later than I would have wanted to, because I had to save the money to do it because I didn't want to put myself behind. But there's huge conversations always in the Facebook group about how people are affording it. And then once you've got the child as well, it's also financially, if you're doing it on your own, is how you're going to have the life that you want for this family, because you've already had to give up. Maybe you thought you were going to have, you know, traditional mum and dad get married, live happily ever after, two incomes. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't want to have to work full time, but can I do that? Can I be the mum that I want to be for this child based on everything?
I know we've been a bit like doom and gloom. Mm. And it is intense
stuff. And we weren't
stuff.
Going to be.
We weren't going to be. No, but one thing I want to say, and I think I kind of touched on it earlier, is these conversations and this difficulty, like, it does mean that the kind of auntie you are, which we're talking about backstage, and the kind of parents we are, like, putting yourself through these paces can mean that you come out of this, out the other side, really equipped to, like, advocate for your kid in the health system, have difficult conversations with people in your life. Like, it's rough that, like, working with fertility and working with trying to create babies in unconventional ways is rough, but it does, like, make you a really robust parent in a particular way. And so I don't want it to be all like, oh, it's a downer. Like, there's so many ways that I parent now that I wouldn't have parented had I not had this, like, 5-year process that was really hard, and so many choices I've made about how I, like, work with other operate among other families and among my friends and loved ones, and no doubt for you as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think, like, I'm a really deadly auntie, and I think that's really good. And like, I wanted to also flag too, like, one of the reasons that I was so happy to be on this panel is because so often the discourse when you're looking through it, and I'm going to just make a guess that there are people here that are interested in assisted fertility and say that, you know, we so often only hear that, yep, my bub is 4 or, you know, I've got my child. You don't hear my story very often. And so I want to say, I hope it works out for those of you here. I really do. But I was really lucky. I have a psychologist who, from the day I started talking to him about this, would sit me and say, Mel, what does your life look like if it doesn't work, if you don't have a baby? What is life for you if you don't have a mum? And in the beginning, all I could say things was like, oh, well, I can go on big international holidays whenever I want to. And I couldn't like find happy. I had to look for things I could do that I could felt that I couldn't do with the child. Like, before I had my hysterectomy, I was happy. Like, I went in that room and he said, what does life look like? Because when this happens, that is the reality for you. And my life is great. Like, it's full of joy and kids and being an auntie to so many other kids. My friends' kids call me auntie, and my friends know what I've been through. And so therefore, like, I am auntie and get to give them presents and, you know, pick them up from school and fill them full of ice cream and take them home to mum and dad and be like, ha ha, suckers on you. I want you to know that this wasn't the option that I thought of, but it's my option and it is good. So however it works out, you will be okay. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go to...
Can I just say that if you are considering solo motherhood, it's not nearly as scary as what you think it's going to be once you're on the other side of it. And it's by far the best thing I have ever done. And I'm a much better mum not having a partner than what I would be. And I can already see how it would have worked out if I'd stayed with my ex-husband and it would have been toxic and whingy. And But my daughter is probably one of the most happy, kind, well-adjusted kids I've ever met. And we have such a beautiful community of other solo mums. Every year I run a trip to Bali. This year we've got 32 mums and their kids coming. So it really normalises our families for our kids, and it helps them see. So when they're growing up, they know so many other donor-conceived kids that, you know, if there are any issues, they've got people to talk to. We are all probably way too open about the fact that they're donor-conceived. Like, kid will go to old men at the bus stop and say, I don't have a dad, I have a donut. And she's so confident in her story.
I was that kid.
Yeah, I was that kid
explaining how babies were made to other kids in kindergarten. And then, like, people being to my parents, like, if your 5-year-old used the word sperm a little less... That would be great. But it's great. It means that you're so understanding about bodies and how they work. You're good at advocating for yourself, like being donor conceived rules.
Yeah. And there's just so many more women doing this as well. My daughter started school last year, and in her class there was another solo mum child. And I was like, oh, you have to be my best friend. She's like, who the hell are you? She's not on social media. But now we're really good. And so my daughter already has someone else in her class. There's another one the year up, and then we've already found another. So there's 4 in our school, which is not that diverse an area. And it's like, and the friendships I've made with other women who've taken this path are just the best friendships I've had my whole life. And my daughter and the ones who have sons, like, they're being brought up surrounded by strong women and, like, really just incredible people. And it's like, how are they not going to be incredible themselves to know that you're not going to let anything stop your dreams coming true? You're just going to go and make it happen. You'll find a way. Yeah. So.
Okay, questions. What can doctors or clinics do to be more accessible and inclusive to single parents by choice or same-sex couples?
I mean,
marketing would be a start.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's the systemic and individual choices. So things like fixing the forms so they don't have expected gender and fixing the language they use, especially because also trans people, like we've been talking about motherhood a lot, but there's a lot of like trans men wanting to get pregnant, trans women wanting to donate as well. So forms and paperwork and training for staff, obviously. But broadly speaking, I don't think that these clinics should be allowed to be corporations. I think healthcare should be government funded. And yeah. I think when you apply a profit framework to healthcare, no amount of changing forms is going to make that system work for marginalised people.
I think the clinics, thinking about their language is really important, and particularly before you've paid the money to be a member of the clinic. Because for me, in that experience now, I think if I'd been told before I handed over my card, there's 5 donors on the list right now. Mm-hmm. None of them are black fellas. None of them are people of colour. If you want Australian, you have to do 2 IUIs before you can have IVF. And that the counselling appointment is going to be so binary. And I was asked whether I was gay or straight. That was the first question I had, and it was either way, and I didn't answer. And so then got, hopefully one day when you meet a man and you can tell them that their dad, not the donor. Like, it was just terrible language that they used that already put me in a really vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. And they'd already taken my money, so I didn't feel empowered to go back and be like, give me my money back.
Yeah. For most of my people now, I'm just like, do your research based on this boom program. Mm-hmm. Whereas years ago, I would have said based on location because you have to go there so much. But it's like, if the clinic's not willing to answer your questions before you're joining them about what this boom program is like, how many they've got in quarantine, how many they've got of the specific ethnicity that you're looking for, yeah, then that's a red flag not to go with them. And don't be loyal to a specialist if they're not making you feel like included and understood.
Mate, imagine you're asking a friend for sperm now. How would you ask them? Where would you take them? What's the first thing you say?
Please, sir, can I have a cup?
I want to have a baby. Have you ever thought about donating sperm? Sorry, I know this is an awkward conversation. Totally fine if the answer's no. Like, I'd just say it. Like, of course it's awkward. And I would talk about it in a casual way. And then if they were like, yeah, I've thought about it, I'd say, well, can we make a time to sit down and talk about it with seriousness? And like, a bit of flattery never hurt no one. Like, I think you're a lovely person. I think you're an interesting person whose friendship I trust. Mm. I'm looking for someone because I really want to have a child and I think you'd be an amazing person. The worst they can say is, I'm not up for that. And I did have a couple of those sorts of conversations because of Cameron living in Canada at the time. So I would start quite casual. I think if you sit someone down, like you've got a pitch, that's quite intense. But I think you would start casual saying, I really want to conceive and I don't have a donor. Have you ever thought about it? I think you're amazing. And then if they say yes, say, oh, well, would you be up for getting a meal or coming over for it? Like, we sat down and had a drink with Cameron once it was really happening and had a proper, like, more serious conversation about boundaries and expectations. But you can set those kind of expectations up once you sit down. I wouldn't come with, like, a contract. I would start quite casual and see if it's even something they'd thought about and give them a bit of time to think about it.
Mm. Alicia, I feel like this is a good one for you. When choosing an unknown donor, how have you explained to your child that you don't know all the details of the other person that helped create them?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I try to tell most people is just sticking to the facts when you're talking about the donor, because until you've met them, you don't know if they're actually going to be the person that you hoped they were when you selected them from a piece of paper. So it's talking about, we know that they were this tall, we know they had this colour hair and eyes, we get information on their parents, we know their ethnicity, we know their health history. And then most clinics now will have some sort of essay answer questions at the donor, so you get a bit of an insight into their personality from that. But it's just making sure you really stick to the facts, so you can bring, I don't know, maybe they are from Brazil originally. You can bring some Brazil stuff into it or whatever else, but it's not making them out to be the most generous, wonderful person in the world, because you don't know what's going to happen between now and when you make contact. If it is 18 years, they could have been really young when they donated, they now get a partner, the partner's not interested and they don't want to have anything to do with the kid. You just don't know. So it's just making sure you talk about the facts and the fact that you're so grateful that there are people out there who are willing to help women have kids on their own, because she's like the most intentional wanted kid ever, and she loves that. She's like, you just made me all by yourself because you really wanted me, and that's her story, and it's such a positive thing. She will never think that she was an accident or not wanted.
Mm. So. Honesty and transparency from the time that a person is born, and a narrative that is about like love and belonging, and in most cases, if you're a good parent on top of that, you're good to go. Mm. Like, kids can accept all sorts of different narratives if they're presented with positivity and hope and facts.
We're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today.
Generously sharing their very personal stories at the All About Women Festival presented by the 2026 Sydney Opera House were Alicia Burns, the founder of the Solo Mum Society and host of the No Need for Prince Charming podcast, Maeve Marsden, the creative director of Varuna, the National Writers' House and the Blue Mountains Writers' Festival, as well as the fabulous Queer Stories Storytelling Project. Big and Bull and Waka Waka Woman, Dr. Melanie Sayward, is a writer and lecturer in Australian Studies at the University of Queensland, and the moderator, Edwina Story, a journalist, and the lead for The Feed, SBS's youth media brand. Get big ideas on ABC Listen or find us wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review too. It really helps new listeners find us. We'd love you for that. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next on Big Ideas, a former White House insider, author of Inflection Point, Biden, Trump and the Future World Order. Catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.